This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change.
Climate action needs champions, and I'm delighted that Professor Elisa Morguera is with us from Scotland. She's a UN Special Rapporteur, and I'm sure listeners will thrill to that title when they think of the other Italian rapporteur that we have heard so much about, Francesca Albanese. What a champion. So I think Professor Morguera is a dynamic element in the United Nations system, which does get stuck, or it seems to get stuck, in relation to climate. She's been to the Pacific and other climate frontiers to gather information on how to protect human rights in the context of climate change. So welcome, Elisa. How are you feeling about Santa Marta?
I'm feeling very hopeful. As UN Special Rapporteur on Climate Change and Human Rights, I have recommended already that if the climate COP last year did not reach a meaningful and detailed outcome on phasing out fossil fuels, we would have needed a new multilateral process for the states who are willing to advance to do so. And I'm hoping that Santa Marta can be that place, and the leadership of Colombia and the Netherlands is really very important, and any state who will be there is really crucial for all of us to keep hope that we can move away from fossil fuels and towards a safer climate.
Yes. Well, I have very high hopes for the Santa Marta conference, but do you think the media will see how significant it is? Their focus is always on the short-term things, the conflict, and the Straits of Hormuz at the moment have absolutely galvanized the whole of world attention, a complete tragedy, and we don't even know how it's going to turn out there. Whereas this conference is about long-term strategies for survival, and I think it's far more important and should get media attention, but do you think it will?
Well, no, I think we have to work towards keeping media attention on Santa Marta, but actually even more significantly, I think when we're looking at our current conflicts, and particularly the illegal armed aggressions we have witnessed since the beginning of the year, those are very much actions that are linked to trying to preserve the fossil fuel-based economy. They're not separate from climate change. So the fact that often the media and even Davos this year have been portraying this, well, the geopolitics is taking over as a higher risks than climate change, is actually a misperception. Those are completely interlinked issues, and addressing climate right here, right now, is both a short-term and long-term approach. The fact that our cost of livings are going up, the cost of not only fuel, but also fertilizers and food are going up, they're all linked to this more and more escalating dynamics of violence, including armed conflict, to protect a very harmful economic system based on fossil fuel that is causing climate change. And it's only enriching, you know, not even 10% of the population at incredibly high and, you know, unconscionable costs for everyone else.
Yes. Well, listeners are a bit impatient with the United Nations, but you're an expert on international law, and it seems to me that at the moment there's no internationally respected law. Well, you wonder which laws are respected at the moment. There seems to be so much impunity, as you said, in this awful crisis is just escalating. But it seems to me we need international law which helps us manage this fair phase out of fossil fuels. It is a big thing to phase out one economic system in the time frame that we've all been talking about for 20 years. And without causing, I think climate change is causing more civilizational damage than the bombs that are presently dropping. And yet it's not understood that way. We need laws that everybody gets behind. What's your thought about that?
So, first of all, international law already exists to phase out fossil fuels in a way that is fair, equitable, orderly, where we have also solidarity among states. All the law we need is already there, and that's been confirmed time and again, not only in my own work, but also, for instance, the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, which was the most historically the biggest process before the International Court of Justice. And of course, it was led by Pacific students and Pacific states. So the law is there, and the fact that we see so much impunity, and not only that, but so much attacks against law and the international legal order, in a way shows that international law matters, that it makes states uncomfortable, and this is why they're trying to avoid it and they're destroying the systems, including the UN systems with defunding and other attacks, including against my colleague Francesca Albanese. So while this is an expression of disregard for international law, it also shows that international law matters. Otherwise, states wouldn't go to this great length to try and destroy this system that, at the very least, puts a shining light on their unacceptable and harmful behavior.
Yes. Oh, yes. I've been horrified by United Nations, for example, UNRWA in Palestine, absolutely bombed and workers killed and United Nations workers and peacekeepers killed. It's really becoming quite Wild West. So what ideas came out of, I have to change, I could go on so many things, but I know you could too. But look, I was interested that you had a conference in Durham University. And you were doing many workshops there, and I wonder what ideas came out of that that can be taken to Santa Marta regarding the essential legal framework.
Well, first of all, that we need to work together across groups of experts and social movements that have tended to be a bit separate. So phasing out fossil fuels both means supporting renewables and closing down fossil fuel operations, but it also means, for instance, looking into plastics production and petrochemicals. This is where oil and gas are expanding, but often this is seen as a separate sector from the energy sector. But in fact, the industry are very interlinked. Their profit making is planned together, and crucially, the impacts on the climate and on our human health are interlinked. What happens in the energy sector and what happens in the food sector, that's all harming the climate system and our capacities to be resilient in the context of climate, as well as causing so many other elements of ill health for all of us. So it's important that the different movements and experts in academia as well connect, realize that we need to compare notes and come together to propose very joined up action to states. And why
Yes.
is this important is also to show into states that they're not gonna miss out on some opportunities because of the withdrawing from fossil fuels. There are just like so many benefits. It's incredible how many benefits for everyone there will be in, ensuring that we may have a life that's free from fossil fuels. And that kind of changes the appreciation of cost benefits. And I think particularly for taxpayers, really to see where are our money going. They're still going into harmful activities that make us ill, that make us poor, that make us insecure. Whereas all the science across the board is showing that moving away from fossil fuels would improve everyone's life in the short term as well, if it's done in careful ways, not just a distant future where, in the meantime, it's all sacrifices.
This is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yawuru Country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time.
It's easy to say in a fossil fuel exporting country like Australia that we should stop subsidizing the coal, oil, and gas. That really costs millions every year. And then globally, it's in the trillions. And we should also, we're talking a lot here about windfall taxes at the moment on our gas because we're exporting gas and we don't have enough here. But how do you apply financial levers like that without suffering a terrific political backlash? And for the workers, and it has to be structured.
It has to be structured, but we also have to be make some distinctions. The economic sacrifice we're calling for is the sacrifice for companies who have the most exorbitant profits that we've ever seen in the history of humanity. And they're making these profits because they're being subsidized, and because we as citizens and taxpayers are also picking up all the bills of the harm that they make and never compensate themselves. You know, our health costs, again, pollution costs, the higher cost of living. This is all things that they, you know, they're provoking and we are paying for. So that all the ways in which we are paying into an industry should be taken into account. But this is also workers and their families who are subsidizing their own industry. The second thing that's interesting is I've spoken to many workers in the fossil fuel companies, and they actually want to have a conversation with their employers about phasing out. They want to be able to be reskilled and move into another industry, and they're not being given that possibility. So again, it's not that workers are necessarily against. They want to be part of the conversation. And in fact, the first barrier is that their very own employers do not want to open up the conversation, let alone give them the money, which will make the transition equitable, for them to be reskilled and to look into other employment opportunities.
Where have you seen examples of that really working? For some years ago, we interviewed people from Germany who talked about that energy vendor, and they seemed to consult everybody, all the stakeholders were involved. But where else have you seen this really working?
Yeah, so I haven't done very detailed work, you know, country by country, but what I've learned is that there have been good examples of phase out, usually specific to one, you know, be that coal or be that gas. So the point is that, you know, if we pick one over another, that's not the whole work. But I think everywhere where we have an inclusive conversation is where we make progress. Because the point is, we just need to listen to all the sides of this debate, who's going to miss out, but also who has the knowledge to understand how we can do this in an equitable way and multiplying benefits for society. And that can't be a small group of people. It needs to be all of us. So to me, the point is a inclusive conversation where we can all share our concerns, where we can all share our insights into, you know, what we risk and what we are there to gain.
Children will be speaking at Santa Marta. I interviewed someone in Colombia and she said they've been working a lot to integrate the human rights thread into all of this, which could just sound very economical and political, but children will actually be speaking at Santa Marta. And I'd like you to paint us a picture of what you have seen in your travels, collecting information for your big report about damage to children's future caused by fossil fuel, even living near a petrochemical industry, for example, that's terrible for your health, but through the climate change that's caused by fossil fuels. Can you give us some examples or some pictures?
Yeah, and I think children are incredible strong force, and they have everything to gain and everything to lose in this conversation. It's very clear that fossil fuels make intergenerational harm. So we know that children already in the maternal womb are already pre-polluted by the toxics that come from fossil fuels and plastics. And then as they're born, not only they're very, you know, I can't imagine what, you know, a child of 5 years, and I've met many, has already been living through five major climate impacts. In Australia, many children are survivors of wildfires and other extreme climate events. I mean, what is that like? You know, imagine that your life is, you know, a thin thread and no one is really doing what is very well known as needed. So there's the mental health, the climate anxiety, and that knowledge that not only they're not being heard, but the possibilities, the choices for their future life are really what's being eroded every time a state decides to postpone or deny or obstruct climate action. So it's essential to listen to children because they have that very, I think, deep understanding of what's at stake. And we should all relate to that. And we do owe it to them to take the human rights approach to really make sure we're making the choices that are protecting the most vulnerable in this situation.
We had a court case in Australia, which was quite famous. Some young people were taking to court this idea of generational loss. And they took it to court that the Minister for the Environment had a duty of care to them, for their generation and future generations. And the judge Agreed. And they won that court, but the Minister for the Environment took it to a higher court and it was thrown out. And it was such a setback. You know, that was such a setback. I don't know what's happened legally since then, but those children, everyone who was involved in that was very disappointed. And I think I'd really like to hear how we can at Santa Marta start really taking this really seriously and put in place some sort of global recognition of that generational right to life.
Well, so that's where human rights is really helpful because I think this idea of intergenerational equity is unfortunately still quite open. And, politicians and even courts might say, well, I'm not quite sure what law I'm applying here. But if we look at the Convention on the Rights of the Child, this is one of the most widely ratified treaties. It's very detailed and really beautiful to read about what we all owe to children, what states owe to them, what all adults owe to them, and in particular, their right to life, survival, and development. I think is a crucial right to really understand that we need to think about children, not just the children today and how they are, but how they will develop tomorrow, what they need when they're 5 year old, when they're 10 year old. And crucially, the science, particularly medical science, is very clear about what the windows of vulnerability are, what the conditions of life are essential for children to grow healthy and develop in all their capacities. So my sense is that we often think, oh, human rights, make things more complicated. But in fact, human rights law just really clarifies these are the obligations, and this is why they're in place. And we have the science to understand how we can go about implementing them. And as I was saying earlier, it just shines a very clear light about what is owed to children. And that may be, I have a feeling that we don't always use to the maximum extent international human rights law to really clarify that matters that may seem of political discretion are actually not open for discretion. They're very clear cut, and we need minimum action by states to prevent what are foreseeable and, in fact, now very widespread harm to children across all their lived experience and their futures.
You mentioned the Pacific and the Honourable Ralph Reginvanu is quite a hero there. He's from Vanuatu, and he said, there's a quote, he said, "We want to shape what happens at Santa Marta." And from your experience of the Pacific, you know, they're such resilient people and they're such leaders and they lead in a different way than many other places. From your experience, how will it be different if the roadmap from out, you know, produced maybe at Santa Marta is shaped by people from the front line rather than people who are making profits?
Well, so first of all, Santa Marta will not develop a roadmap. The idea is there will be only a technical report. And I think this might seem low ambition, but I think it's actually really crucial. We need states from all regions exporting, importing fossil fuels, more exposed to climate change or a bit less, to come together and create a strong coalition. And for that, we don't need to rush to, the end line. Let's see what they need to come together, what they understand. And so in that sense, it's good to know that Santa Marta will be the first international conference, but we already know that there are plans for a second one, which most likely will be held in the Pacific. And that will also give us a chance to think about how different regions, and certainly the Pacific region, has been a leader globally in so many areas and needs to be a voice of shaping those conversations, both in terms of the content, but also the approach. And this is how all of us as participants in Santa Marta should also support that learning from different regions and supporting a process that's inclusive of all voices, but particularly those of the countries who are being so much more affected by climate change than others, because in all that pain and that loss, there's also unique insights into how we get out of this crisis, and that must be honored. And we all have to learn so much from that.
Yeah, I love you saying that.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire. And this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had three in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Well, we're chatting with Professor Elisa Morguera, and her report to the United Nations included a breathtaking chapter on disinformation. Now, Elisa, you want criminal penalties for platforms peddling disinformation about the climate crisis. Describe some of the items in what you call the playbook of climate obstruction.
Yes, so unfortunately, we have now very clear independent evidence that the fossil fuel companies, but increasingly I've realized also plastics producing companies, petrochemicals, even some of our food and water, food and beverage companies have all been using this playbook of disinformation. And what it is that for some of the major fossil fuel companies already from 6 decades, if not more, they knew they had scientific evidence that they were going to cause climate change. And instead of releasing that information to public authorities, they came up with multiple strategies to keep the public away and decision makers away from that reality. And this playbook goes from, for instance, attacking climate scientists, discrediting them, but also providing finance to research centers to produce counterfeited evidence. And then there's all the advertising, greenwashing, and it goes in very subtle ways to kind of creating in our minds over decades this idea that we can't live without fossil fuels, that modernity and our well-being are interdependent from fossil fuels, as opposed to telling us all the way in which fossil fuels have caused planetary crises that we've never seen before and are also harming us day in, day out, with, you know, also the loss of biodiversity and toxic pollution in so many ways, in ways that are now very much internalized in our bodies. And all the companies that work with them are contributing to spreading that disinformation. So also we need to look at the advertising. For instance, sport sponsorship is huge. And more those social media and AI-generated content are spreading that disinformation to unprecedented levels. And crucially, providing a profit back to oil and other fossil fuel companies.
Yeah, I think you've also saw that they have a kind of confusing element in which affects democracy itself. It destroys trust in public institutions. Mm. And that's why I was saying people keep telling me, oh, the United Nations is useless. You know, don't interview anyone from the UN. Well, you're a rapporteur to the UN, but I feel our distrust of the United Nations has been somehow poisoned by this kind of disinformation. But have you got evidence of that? Or, you know, can you see examples where that actually happens?
We actually had a whole forum last year about protecting democracy and rule of law. And it was looking at climate change and environment and really seeing how decades of disinformation, but also lobbying, what they call revolving doors, so industry experts working in government, coming out of government and going back to the industry with insights about what regulations are being planned, you know, and the proactive undue influence in policy making from UN level, climate COP, plastics negotiations, all the level to our national and local decision making, all of that has weakened our democratic systems. And this is really the price we're paying for keeping this kind of industry giving up on our democratic institutions. And we all have a right to information. We all have a right to science, to benefit from the advancements on science. And we, you know, all our other rights are, you know, dependent on us having access to trustworthy information. So it's really kind of a very basic approach to really say we can't accept what are now very well documented modalities of disinformation. And states need to take action both in preventing further actions of disinformation, but also in undoing this work of decades that has shaped our minds. And so through education, through public awareness, make the public aware that they have been lied to for decades, and that, you know, we know what the lies are, and people need to be aware when they make their own choices that, you know, these are the things that have been told that are not correct. And the science is telling us differently. Our own life experiences, our own health is telling us differently. And the links are very clear.
Is that happening in Europe, and or are there companies that are prosecuted for disinformation?
There are increasing litigation against disinformation. But it remains, of course, a very delicate area because, of course, what I was saying earlier, we need public debates. And we need anyone who has, you know, their understanding of the science or of climate, or of the benefits of fossil fuels, to be able to share their views and have a conversation. Because only through conversation and dialogue, we are able to together co-develop a path away from fossil fuels that is fair to all. But I think that conscious and, you know, long-standing approach to disinforming with a very clear return in profits and, you know, such very clear structure of attacks to our information basis and public systems of participation, that is now so well known that I think there'll be more and more litigation going on. I think we've seen that in the US as well. So it's, I think it's coming. And in itself could be a game changer.
Great. Just to finish, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has recently called on the IEA to create a global platform to, and he quote, he said, to sequence the decline of fossil fuel investment with the rapid scale up of clean energy, end of quote. So I think Santa Marta is the starting place for that. With a close focus on fossil fuels. It's not all the other subjects that come up at COPs, it's just the fossil fuel. So if Santa Marta is a starting place with this coalition of willing countries, and we've got the fossil fuel treaty, you know, pretty well developed, and the coalition led by Netherlands to phase out fossil subsidies, those are two big ideas that keep coming through the interviews. What do you hope to report to the United Nations if this conference goes well? What sort of things would you like to see?
I think monitoring is really important. This idea that we keep track of what is happening, who's making progress, and celebrate states who are making progress. But it's not just about the numbers. It's also about what we learn, what we're learning in that country that can be helpful to other countries. And in fact, many of your questions were about that. What we've learned in places where we have made progress in phasing out fossil fuels. And I think to me, that is the importance of Santa Marta, to start a process where countries realize we all need to learn from one another. We need to have an open understanding of how our economic systems, finance systems are changing, because we are moving into, you know, something that is, that's never been done before. And that exchange of learnings is what can help other people to leapfrog ahead, not prevent doing same mistakes that may have been done elsewhere. So to me, the like mutual learning is also what will feed hope, and what will feed also cooperation among states, because we know the finance is international. A lot of money is going to fossil fuels through illicit financial transactions and tax havens. There's all other, you know, international forms of subsidizing. And of course, there's also pressures, you know, from exporters, importers. So we need that fruitful dialogue going on. And I think that's as important as the numbers and the tracking and that sense of progress.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I don't know why more journalists haven't really picked it up yet. Maybe when it's happening, they'll get the idea. But to me, in the present historical moment, this is a historical conference, don't you think?
It is. And the fact that states, you know, spoke up and said we are not making the progress we need in the UN Climate COP, we're still going to be engaged, but we're going to create a new space where those who want to make progress will make progress, and where we are welcoming academics, indigenous people, cities, unions, everyone who also wants to make progress and has critical knowledge. And I think that's what we need. And it's the leadership of the states who will be there, is incredible. It's what we need. And we should all do our best to nourish that and hold them accountable as well to that.
Well, it's been lovely to meet you on the Zoom, and I wish you really well for your trip to Santa Marta, and good luck to you for all those conferences. It must be exhausting to do that in a big conference like that, but I'm sure we'll be able to report on it later as a modified successor. If you, as you said, it won't be exactly a roadmap necessarily coming out of it, but there'll be lots of liaisons and networks formed. There's 85 countries that signed the Belém Declaration, so that's big. You know, that's a big amount of world GDP, isn't it? So.
Yeah. And again, we shouldn't just think that states will do this. What we're also seeing is that there can be a lot of helpful bottom-up initiatives to defossilize, and they can show how this is possible, how people benefit from it. So I think Santa Marta is also connecting so many movements that from the bottom up can pilot and show, you know, do some of the work, you know, with states and show, well, this has been possible here. Let's see what can be done now on your side, so that we're not leaving states alone in this. You know, there's so many people who want to help, who are keen to make this work happen and be as fair and as beneficial as possible.
Very good. Thank you very much. That was Professor Elisa Morguera in Scotland talking to us today, but she's going to Santa Marta as the UN rapporteur on human rights in the context of climate change. What bigger job could there be? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vivian. It's been a pleasure.
Wasn't that brilliant? If you'd like to read Elisa Morguera's groundbreaking report for the United Nations, look it up under The Imperative to Defossilize Our Economies. It's a very serious read, but so worthwhile. Now, here's Ali Primera, Venezuela's most famous singer, with his song honoring activists who died for social justice. And then we'll go to Colombia.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.
And from Bogota now, I have a guest from the Climate Action Network of Latin America. So welcome to Laura Restrepo. Let's start with Colombia. It's a coal and oil exporter, and yet President Gustavo Petro is committed to winding down Colombia's economic dependence on fossil fuels. I think he's an absolute hero. I think it's a wonderful development, but so dangerous. People say it's economic suicide. So tell us how you're doing it in Colombia.
Yeah, thank you, Vivian. It's really nice to be here. And yes, in Colombia, the Petro administration has introduced a paradigm shift, not only energetic, but also macroeconomic, as you are saying. Colombia is actually implementing a roadmap that prioritizes the suspension of new exploration contracts, for example, focusing on maximizing the energy efficiency and also the efficiency of the existing fields. He's actually trying to diversify the national export bases and also the national activities, how to reindustrialize the country, but not depending as much on fossil fuels. And actually this week, we had a news related that Colombia right now is producing more renewable energy than, for example, coal. And that's historic because Colombia is one of the main exporters of coal. So this is really huge. And in the Petro government, in this administration, this is articulated through the National Development Plan, because this plan seeks to transition from an extractive economy towards a productive economy for life. That's the name that they use, based on sustainable tourism, for example, or agriculture. So he's trying to diversify the internal economy. But I also think that one of the primary challenges is the fiscal substitution, because oil represents a significant portion of the GDP inside Colombia and also our export revenue. So yeah, this is huge. But Colombia, he is also trying to lead the international conversation related with the sustainable finance and how the innovative mechanisms of finance are necessary to create fiscal space to fund the just transition without destabilizing the balance of payments. And I really think that it's really important to say that Petro and our environmental ministries, they are also trying to talk more about the debt and the struggles that Latin American countries have to lead or to proceed with the just energy transition, because we are highly in debt countries. So we also need to focus on how we are going to bring new models of financing and maybe open new fiscal space and not debt projects to really approach to this.
And so you're leading with this Santa Marta conference, but when the international community realizes that they can benefit a country like yours, who are taking the lead, pay for it, it'll be wonderful. And just I could put a little tiny word in here. I have been to Colombia, and if anyone's thinking of tourism there, it is the most beautiful and varied country. I started down in the Amazon or in Leticia, and then went up to the mountains, and we went on horseback along the Rio Magdalena. We saw these archaeological statues, something called Lava Patas, little pool of Lava Patas. It was absolutely so varied and so beautiful in the mountainous country, in the old cities, old, you know, Spanish colonial sort of looking cities. Mm-hmm. People should go there. And it isn't really, I don't know many people who say, oh, I love going to Colombia. So tourism should be a really good draw card, I think.
Yeah.
But look, let's get back to the conference. The Santa Marta mm-hmm. conference is organized around three thematic pillars. Now, I don't want listeners to get bogged down in this. It could be a bit hard. It took me a while to read it all and understand what it is. But they're trying to say, look, there's three themes. We're just focusing on getting away from the fossilized economy. So tell us some of the best ideas on the table around that first pillar, which is how to overcome economic dependence on fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. From my perspective, this first pillar requires differentiated strategies for exporters and importers, no? And for example, for exporting nations, the key lies on this planned economic diversification that we are just doing inside Colombia, and also the creation of sovereign funds that reinvest, for example, the fossil fuels revenues or rents into non-conventional energy projects, for example. And for importers, I think that it's really important to focus on energy sovereignty. And this, of course, involves how to reduce vulnerability to international price volatility, like, for example, you were saying as the Hormuz Strait. So I think that it's really important to focus on how to reduce this vulnerability. And this will be through the electrification of the demand and also the distributed generation, the distributed energy generation, that it's really important. And this will, for us, break the monopoly of imported fuels and democracy's energy access. And I think that this also means how we are going to create, as I was saying before, this fiscal space to invest on the just energy transition. And for example, from CANLA, we presented a submission and we also addressed the ISDS policies, because for example, in countries like Colombia and also in some other countries in Latin America, the ISDS close our fiscal space or close our opportunities to invest national money in just transition, because we need to pay high debts to private sector because they find that they are like failing on how to extract in our countries. No, I think that ISDS is one of the biggest topics that we are right now talking in the conference, not just CANLA, but also another networks. We're also trying to approach to ISDS segments.
Yeah. So you're being blocked from doing the energy revolution or doing climate action by these commercial interests who say, oh no, we want to continue exploiting and you're stopping us exploiting, and so we're going to charge you. This is like a legal nightmare for many countries. Canada, a lot of countries are facing this now. And I think just for listeners, just to think about this difference between exporters and importers. If you're an importer, like many Pacific Islands, you know, they're dependent on diesel imports for their whole electricity grid, PG, for example. But islands like Cuba is dramatically being shown to the world. They're being starved now. First, the long-standing embargo, but now fueled by telling Mexico and other and Venezuela, no, you can't export to Cuba, just across the road there, across the sea. It's a shockingly dramatic example how vulnerable we are as importers. Australia imports fuel as well as exporting coal and gas. But I think this is surely a dramatic, teachable moment for the world to start thinking, really, each nation, well, how vulnerable we are. We need to have much more sovereignty over our energy, especially.
My name's Darryl Best. I worked all my working career in coal mines. I am now passionate about a transition to renewables and about saving our planet. And you are listening to the Climate Action Radio Show on Community Radio. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
You're listening to the Climate Action Show on 3CR, and we're talking to Laura Restrepo from Climate Action Network Latin America. Let's get to the second pillar. Oh, no, before we do that, I was thinking this extractive economy that everybody notices now, it's so damaging all around the world. We've paid such a high price for it. And increasingly, even extractive forests, extraction in, Australia's like a quarry, really. So we know about extraction here. But this pattern of dependency on something that you can extract could just continue with critical minerals. And that's the next big thing. And I think President Trump is making a pretty clear play for critical minerals in Ukraine, in Greenland, in, grab them. And that's because that's the next thing. So what safeguards do you think the conference will talk about, to prevent people being kicked off their land, to have their water stolen, and huge environmental damage, irreparable damage being left behind? What do you think the conference will think are the main best ideas for that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this thing that you bring here, it's really important because we can't allow that the decarbonization of the global north results in green colonization to the global south, as we are envisioning right now that it's happening. And this to avoid this replication of the old extractivist model, because it is an extractivist model. We are not just changing. I mean, from Canada, we've been saying a lot that we just can't change the extractivism from oil, gas and coal to the extractivism of minerals and raw materials. So it's really imperative to implement binding human rights clauses, environmental due diligence, for example. And for us, it's really unconditional the respect for free, prior and informed consent, not just for indigenous communities, but also for Afro-descendant communities, for the local communities. And also, we think that it's really important to envision how the circular economy frameworks will reduce this pressure on primary mining, for example, because we can bring this circular economy philosophy to the extraction of minerals, so we can reduce the pressure on the extracting phase. And also, I think that it's really important to say that the extraction of minerals must be contingent upon cumulative environmental impact assessments, and really ensuring that this is a significant portion of the value-added chain, and also this portion of the value-added chain remains within the territories. I mean, and I'm bringing examples from Latin America. We have mining in some territories, and the added value chains doesn't remain in the territory. I mean, the benefits are not in the territory. So we have huge minings in Latin America, or extraction of oil, gas, and coal, and the communities, for example, doesn't have energy access, or doesn't have renewable energy projects, even if the extractivism is in the territory. So I think that it's really important also to bring this conversation on how the territories are going to benefit with this extraction of minerals. And I think that it's really important for us to really be cautious about the extractivism, because As you were saying, like, for example, Cuba and the war in Ukraine and also the war with Iran and all that, some of the minerals are being extracted, but not for the just energy transition. Instead, they are being extracted, for example, for the military industry. So we also need to take that into account and how we are going to also bring some scenarios or some clauses that limits the extractivism of minerals for the energy transition, not for killing people, the genocide and some other stuff. So I really think that we also need to focus our conversation on those.
Yeah, great point.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de lucha cabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.
Let's keep moving with the pillars. Listeners, we're talking about the thematic pillars for the Santa Marta Conference, and the conference has got a very close focus on phasing out fossil fuels. So their second theme is about transforming supply and demand. Already we're seeing many countries replacing coal and gas-fired energy. Really around the world, quite a few countries are doing that, like the UK is well ahead on that. China is very well ahead on that. And they're replacing it with renewables and battery power or firming power. So that's launched, you know, a huge improvement in Australia, for example. But global emissions are still rising, especially, well, I think it's from demands from the petrochemical sector for plastics and other, you know, that's a lot of oil and gas goes into that. And it's increasingly there where they're oil and gas is going to, fertilizers and all of that, and AI. So how can countries cooperate to reduce on the demand side? You know, just reduce the demand.
Yeah, the point that you are bringing is really important, because the rise in emissions driven by these petrochemical industries and also the artificial intelligence demonstrate that technological efficiency alone is insufficient if the absolute consumption continues to grow exponentially. No, so I think that we also need to focus on how the consumption is raising and raising, and we are not going into the consumption. Maybe we are focusing too much in the demand, and also how to change the energy used to produce energy, but we also need to rethink how we are consuming energy. So to reduce this demand, we must apply, of course, energy sufficiency policies that go beyond the efficiency, because right now we are seeing that focusing on energy sufficiency is not enough. And this also involves redesigning, for example, the urban systems to reduce, like, for example, motorized transport needs, and also strictly for us, strictly regulating the energy consumption of AI data centers. This is really important right now, because we are in the world, the AI is consuming not just energy, but also huge amounts of water. In Latin America, we have very good examples of how the AI data centers are consuming a lot of energy, but also huge amounts of water.
Where are they in South America? Where are these big data centers? Which countries?
Because we have, for example, one in Mexico related with Amazon. So it's one of the most affected territories, but by Amazon, and they are suffering from water stress. And the community in there doesn't have water for drink. So we have examples in Latin America about this. So for us, regulating this is really important. And also the point that you were bringing about the plastic, we need to really disincentivize, I think that is that the way how it's pronounced, that word, disincentivize the production of plastics, and particularly the single-use plastics, no?
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high-quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Lara Restrepo is speaking to us from Colombia, and we got onto the subject of the United Nations.
I think this conversation has to be, like, you have to put a bomb into this organization to make it reform, but I hope they do reform it rather than abandoning. A lot of people say, oh, the United Nations is no use, let's abandon it. Well, this Santa Marta conference is not abandoning the United Nations. It's a parallel thing, and it's going to feed back into the United Nations. But I think, as you say, they can't keep going on with this consensus decision-making, which can be blocked by one or two countries, Saudi Arabia, or the oil producers can just say no.
Yes, totally, totally. I will just say that this, of course, the Santa Marta Conference is a complement mechanism. It's a complementary mechanism. They don't know if they are going to bring like a new treaty or just a coalition. But of course, it's going to also bring some insights to the UNFCCC and to the COP presidency this year, to the COP30 and COP31 presidency. So we will see how this will work inside the UNFCCC and how they are going to receive the information after Santa Marta. But I also think that we need to take into account that maybe the UNFCCC is not the right place to put this conversation. Maybe we also need to refocus our fight for the fossil fuel. And yes, that doesn't mean that we need to abandon the UNFCCC, because the UNFCCC, it's been instrumental to bring climate change conversations to some countries, and also paradigm change. It's really important. And the UNFCCC, it's been key for that. So it's not abandoning the UNFCCC, but it's also thinking creative, like in a creative way, how we are going to also bring these complementary mechanisms. We are going to push to have deeper conversations on how the fossil fuel dependence is also deepening the wars in like around the globe. So how we are going to face the war, the fossil fuel extractivism, the mineral extractivism, and also have this conversation about the US and the geopolitics are going to merge with these kind of things, because there's a lot of countries actually in Latin America that they haven't confirmed that they are going to be present in there because they are afraid of Trump, for example. So we are not expecting this as a result, because it's not a competence that the conference have, but we are expecting that this conversation is going to be really vivid in Santa Marta, how it the geopolitics is.
It couldn't be a more important moment to have this, and I hope people aren't afraid to go, and I hope the media, the world media, will suddenly realize you have to focus not just on the responding to the immediate thing. You have to think of the vision for the future. You have to, as I said, make something thinkable, and your conference is going to make things thinkable. It'll put it out there. What are the possibilities? So let's just talk about the historic moment we're in just a little bit, because your organization put a manifesto up. I was looking, what do you represent? And you condemned the military attack on Venezuela, which shocked us all at the beginning of this year. And you stand in solidarity with all those who defend human rights, as you've said throughout in the region, like journalists and Indigenous people and academics who are being murdered, literally murdered. But in Australia, people are put in prison. And, you know, we're getting to the pointy end. We always knew it was going to be a battle. Fossil fuel, I never realized years ago when I started doing this program, I never realized the fossil fuel lobby could be so strong and so vicious and so mendacious. You know, they have lied about the impact on the climate that they have known themselves. for many years. But we're coming now, I think, to the pointy end, and we have to be brave, but we have to be also resourceful, you know, tactful, resourceful, diplomatic, knowing all the ways to disarm power, I would like to say, because as you say, it is all has also resulting now in war. What would your last words be? How can we hold the line? You know, you're in touch with a lot of groups. They take action in a lot of different ways. Young people, as you say, Indigenous people, all these different battle lines where Climate Action Network represents people and you want them to be shielded. What are your last words about holding the line?
I will say that what we are discussing in Santa Marta is just not a technical shift and that it's really important for us as CANLA, as Latin American people. We are not seeking for a technical shift in power grids or a reorganization of a fiscal spreadsheet or a fiscal space. For us, this is a profound act of courage, as you are saying, and we are witnessing an historical moment, of course, and also being from Colombia, and despite its economical reliance in oil and coal, economy must be a subsidiary of ecology and not the other way around. Like, we are part of the planet, and we are not owning the planet. And for me, that's really important to say. For us, it's not just a technical shift. It's a deep conversation on how we relation on how it's our relationship with nature, and the transition from the unthinkable to the inevitable, as you said in the beginning, it's already underway. So we also need to take that into account. And this transition needs to be driven by the conviction that we cannot build a prosperous future on a dying climate. And I think that it's a conversation about how to defend life, not how to defend profit. And also we need to center justice in the conversation, how to protect the guardians in the territories, the indigenous, the Afro-descendants, the women, like all our groups. And also dismantling the legal and economical chains on the fossil fuel era. And I really think that we need to be really creative to that. We are not just avoiding a disaster. We are redesigning a world that it's maybe finally habitable for everyone, not just for a couple that has the money to habit in this world, but habitable for all of us. My last words, maybe, the transition is not a loss of power, but to discover a new way of understanding power, maybe more cleaner, safer, and democratic. And this is also a way to empower all the humanity, not just the powerful ones. And it's time to make this unthinkable in the past to more thinkable in the right now.
Yeah, thank you very much. So listeners, you can see what a lot of exciting things are happening there in Colombia. And we've just been speaking to Laura Restrepo, and she represents Climate Action Network Latin America. So thank you very much, Laura. I wish you the best wishes for this marvelous conference. And please keep us in touch with the results of it. And we'll interview quite a few people afterwards, I think, to find out what happens, because we're living in dangerous times. But as you say, it's actually positive. There's lots of positive work emerging all over the world, and we'll be very surprised. Someone said to me the other day, the darkest hour is before the dawn. And I think that's true. It seems very dark now, but the dawn that you're creating, you're envisioning is going to happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Vivian.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de lucha cabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.
Thanks to Professor Elisa Morguera in Scotland and Laura Restrepo in Colombia. The first international conference on how to phase out fossil fuels starts this week, and I hope to report about it in May. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.